Well, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to assume that most of you believe in death. Because if you don't, we can take this thing in a whole different direction. But if I don't have any unbelievers, we'll talk about that subject. I hope to leave some room for questions and jokes. But my first point is, we've heard all your jokes and none of them are funny. So I did have a Greek Orthodox priest come by one day and he stopped at the mortuary. He's a friend of ours. We love him dear. But Father Andy stopped by and said, "Greg, do you know what they call a pallbearer in Oklahoma?" "It's one I've never heard." I said, "No, I don't, Andy. What do they call it?" He said, "Karaoke's." Only funeral director joke I've never heard, and it was actually somewhat funny. So, anyway, they say that, well, first of all, let me start off by quoting an eminent philosopher and theologian. What is his name? Seinfeld made the comment one time. He said, "Most people, the two greatest fears that most people have is public speaking and death, which means at any given funeral, most people would rather be in the casket than talking about the guy that's in the casket." So I thought that was a great insight into death. Some facts you might not know. It's estimated approximately 100 billion people have died on the earth since the beginning of mankind. 100 billion people. Anybody got a birthday coming up or just had one? 153,000 people died on your birthday. About how many die every year? Any left-handers in here? Excuse me. Left-handers in here? You're, depending on what study you look at, you're 3 to 9 times more likely to die early than a right-hander. And over 2,500 people a year die. Left-handers die from trying to use something that's designed for a right-hander. So just be aware of that. Doctor's illegible handwriting kills more than 7,000 people annually. Someone commits suicide every 40 seconds. Worldwide, 68 people will take their lives while we're in this classroom today. And this is something that I didn't know, and I don't see it in our mortuary, but about 100,000 people attempt suicide, 5,000 succeed, and 90% of the suicides are female. We don't see many females that have committed suicide. We do a lot of suicide. I don't know if Steve, my buddy Steve from Florida, was a chaplain. I was a chaplain, police chaplain. Saw a lot of suicide, but I didn't see many females. Did you? So I wondered about that one. Since you're all going to dinner right after this, probably, here's a good conversation starter. Within 3 days of your death, the enzymes that used to digest your food start eating you. So bring that up at the table. When you die, first your sight goes, then your taste, then your smell, then your touch. But here's a fascinating one. I don't know how they know this, but they say that a human head remains conscious 15 to 20 seconds after being decapitated. How do you know that?
I've looked at the expression in your eyes.
Okay.
The head rolls.
Okay. How many people have you decapitated? We don't know your name. We're not going to talk about death in the sense of what's the biblical definition and that kind of thing. Although, if I get invited back, I might do it. It's a fascinating study of Scripture. Because in the Old Testament, Job's friends, their view of death was basically, you know, when it's over, it's over. The writer of Ecclesiastes says, enjoy life, eat, drink, be merry, because in the end, we're all go to the same place and there's no advantage to being a human over an animal. Which lends me to believe that when Job stood up and said, I know that I shall see my Redeemer, you know, that was a huge leap of faith because that was not the belief of his day. And when David says, well, I might not bring my son back, but I'll go to him, another huge leap of faith. That was not the belief of his day. And when Jesus is talking to Martha and Mary, and he says to Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? And she says, yes. That was not what they believed during that day. So that was a huge departure from the accepted view of death. And so when you look in the scripture, death becomes the Job view, to the point of going from hopelessness to glorious hope with Jesus, where it's a sleep from which we will awaken. But what I want to talk to you about today is just kind of my observations. I was a preacher for over 30 years in churches of Christ. And people ask me often, how did you go from being a preacher to a mortician? And I said, I would rather spend time with dead people than go to elders' meetings. But elders' meetings were another kind of death. But my good friend Steve was one of my elders, Chuck, back there. The last 3 years I preached, I told him, if you need me for anything, let me know. I'll come to your meeting. And I didn't go to an elders' meeting for 3 years. And I have loved those guys for that ever since then. But I want to talk about just some things that I've observed. And the first one's kind of personal, if you'll just let me do it, because it kind of came to me this week. I finished graduate school with training in counseling. I was going to become a counselor. I had a certification in hypnotherapy. And in North Alabama, to put a sign out that says hypnosis is like putting a sign out that says I worship Satan. So it didn't work out that great. But I went into ministry, got invited to preach at a little church, and nobody ever found out, and so I kept preaching. And I ended up preaching for 30 years, three different churches. The last was in Long Beach, California, for about 15 years. When I grew up in North Alabama, the greatest fear of people was, I'm not sure I've been good enough to go to heaven. And I had no way to answer that, because I was brought up in the same belief system. And so when I started preaching at this little country church in Lauderdale County, I'd already finished graduate work, but I enrolled at Harding Graduate School in Memphis and went there for 2.5 years. And I learned how to study the Bible. It's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And I spent 3 years going through everything I'd ever learned and threw out most of it. Scared my mother to death. I shouldn't use that term in this class. She became quite concerned about me. But I discovered things such as grace. And then I moved to a church in Florida, and my buddy Steve was a police chaplain, and I'd been interested in becoming a police chaplain, but they never had one at this little village of about 35,000 people, Rockledge, Florida. And so they weren't sure if they wanted to do that or not. But I was out in the backyard one day building a pool deck around an above-ground pool for my kids, and sirens were blaring just like a block away, and it was just, this was long before cell phones. And my wife called and said, the police department is on the phone, they want to talk to you. So I go in the house, and they said, Greg, there's been a bad accident just about a block away from you. Can you go over there and be with the family? So a little girl had been hit on a bicycle, rushed to the hospital. By then, they had transported her, so I went to the hospital. And they said that there was the injuries to the pons area of her brain. And I called a friend of mine who is an oncology radiologist. I said, Doc, what does this mean? He said, there's no chance of her ever surviving that type of injury. So I walked into the family knowing that, you know, your daughter is not going to survive this, even though she's on life support. And that was my introduction to becoming a police chaplain. It was my introduction to really dealing with death on any kind of a level. And about 3.5 weeks later, that girl walked out of the hospital. And the only thing you could tell was she had a slight limp. And I was the hero of the police department, because nobody knew how to do anything with that situation, and I didn't either. But at least I was there with the family, and that made a huge difference to them and me. And then as a police chaplain, people come to Florida and they die in droves down there in the winter. So I was always doing death notifications for the police department. Eventually wrote the policy and procedure for how to do a death notification. And the officers loved it because they didn't have to do it. They'd bring me along and I would do it. And I'd seen people literally attack the police officer for saying, your loved one is dead. And they would just attack, and that was grief. So when I would do death notifications, I'd always stand right behind the officer and let them know. But I just began dealing with death a lot. Children were drowning. First autopsy I ever went to was a child that had drowned. And the detective on the case and myself, we both had sons about the age of that child. And all I could see was my son laying on that gurney. So I was there to minister to him during that time. We had a situation one Sunday night where a train hit a car right in front of the police department, and they found a little baby mobile in the car, and so they were assumed, and it sent the car like 100 yards down the track. And so we spent the next hour looking for this baby in all the bush and stuff around it. Finally decided that the baby wasn't in the car, and it was my job to, when we found charred driver's licenses, but we finally figured out who these people were, and the next day it's, Greg, we need you to call this person's mother. She lives in Indiana. And I made the call, and I made a call to the police department of that city. I said, we need you to make your death notification for us. Find who was it. When I told them, I said, that's the daughter of our dispatcher.
Oh, wow. Oh.
And if I'd have made that call the night before, she would have been answering the phone, and I would have been giving her that news. So I got brought into this world of death like that, and not bragging, but people said, you have a good way of helping families through death. And so came to Long Beach and eventually became involved with a funeral home there. And although I preached for 30 years, I never really felt called to be a preacher. I never felt comfortable being a preacher. I honestly, people say, how did you get into preaching? And I say, honestly, I snuck through a back door and no one ever called me. And I did it for actually over 30 years. But I was never comfortable. I just never felt like that was my role in life. I thought I was a fairly decent preacher. But what did I say? I paid for that. But I just felt out of place in that role. And so if nothing else, being in the funeral business, I finally look back on my life at all those things I'm telling you about, and I see where God was bringing me to a point that I walked away from the pulpit and entered the most meaningful ministry I've ever done in my life. And we're 90 miles away from Long Beach, and I have no idea how many funerals we've done in Long Beach, but I've done funerals for some of the people, their loved ones sitting in this room today. And that's a huge honor to me and my family to do that. So I, if nothing else, I finally saw, and it bothered me for years, I don't know what my calling is, but I don't think it's ministry, but it turned out to be ministry in another sense. And it's been incredibly not rewarding in the sense financially, because I actually make less money than I made when I was preaching at Long Beach, but it's been hugely rewarding in what we've been able to do to help people through that moment in their lives. So what are some lessons I learned? Death has given me a realistic perspective on life. Ecclesiastes 7:2, better to spend your time at funerals than at parties. After all, everyone dies, so the living should take this to heart. Never really knew what to do with that verse as a preacher. But there's much wisdom in that verse, because death and funerals force us, like nothing else, to see life as it really is. To examine my life, I had a preacher. I did three services with him in 1 week over in Murrieta, and we were going up to Riverside National for a burial. And he said, you know, this person, right before she died, she said, I've got to forgive some people in my family. And she did that, and she died in peace, knowing she had worked that out. But death
realizes, forces us to look at that. And the many times I've sat with families and they've said, you know, if only, if I could, fill in the blank. Death helps us to not live a life of if only, but just go ahead and do whatever it takes to do that. My years in Florida were not exceptionally good. I went down there to work with a preacher who was a very good friend of my parents, and first year was great, and the next seven were horrible. And he and I did not get along. He thought I was too liberal. He thought I was a threat to the church he had built and this and that. So I'd preach a sermon, and he'd get up and refute me the next Sunday. And his son was an elder, so the deck was stacked against me. But he and I did not get along well at all. Though he and his wife had babysat me and my siblings. And I came to Pepperdine while I was still at Long Beach. I went through the conflict training stuff here at the law school. And I told my wife, I said, we've got to go back to Florida. I've got to resolve this with Paul. And we flew back to Florida that summer. And I sat down with Paul and his wife, and I sat down with the elders. And we all departed friends. We all departed with, you know, this is good, this is okay, this is behind us. And about 6 weeks later, Paul died drowned in a fishing accident. And I would have never had that opportunity to make things right with him had I not done that. So death helps me to realize, make things right while you have the ability to do that. When my younger brother just dropped dead 5 years ago, next month, he was the healthiest one of us. So my wife lives the most joy. If you know her, my wife is the most joy-filled, positive person, in spite of having been with me for 47 years that I've ever known. And she just wakes up every day. This is a wonderful gift from God. And I wake up every day, man, I'm still alive. I'm surprised I didn't kill off. And Steve called me the other day on the phone. I said, wouldn't it be the ultimate irony if I was walking to this class on Friday and I just keeled over dead like my brother did? What an object lesson. But I kind of live that way. I'm surprised I'm still alive. But it's taught me to see life as a gift. And my brother and sister and myself that were remaining, there had been some issues between my brother and sister, and my son and I thought we were leaving on this day, and we were actually leaving the next day, so we ended up staying an extra day. And we all got together all day long, and we resolved issues that had been between us for years. Death does that to you. Death is a part of the flow of life. Have you ever read the Psalms and just scratched your head and say, is this schizophrenic or what? Because you've got a psalm that God is good all the time God is good, and the next psalm is, my life is going down the toilet and God, it's your fault. And it's just bizarre to read the Psalms. But what the Psalms do, the Psalms reflect the flow of life and how to worship God through that flow of life. And the psalmist realized, I think, I'm not a huge scholar on the Psalms, but the Psalms reflect the good days and the bad days and the praise days and the prayer days and every emotion that you can possibly deal with. But they seem to have figured out in the Psalms that, guess what? God doesn't fix things. I don't know if you've noticed that in your life, but when I've needed God the most, He seemed to be the furthest away. When I cried out, would you give me something? God could never have been more silent during those periods. And that's Psalms for you. But the one thing the psalmist seems to notice was that when you look back over your life, God's love was constant. And the best way I know to illustrate it, my son, when he was a baby, he fell off the counter. I don't know how he fell off the counter, but he busted his head open. He had to go have stitches. And I was there holding him on the table in the emergency room. And I was, you know, I was assuring him, Daddy's going to be right here. I could not do one thing to stop the pain he was about to go through. But knowing that his daddy was going to be there, we made it through that. And I kind of see God that way many times. I know he's going to be there. He's probably not going to do much to stop what's going on. But our mortuary is filled with families and hope God would fix things, and it didn't happen. And this business has helped me to reflect on the Psalms in that way. I got a call from a friend of mine a couple of months ago now, and we had been in a Bible study together for a few years. We never called each other, never once. And he calls and said, "Greg, this is so-and-so." And he said, I said, "Well, how in the world are you doing?" I wondered about you. He said, "Well, I'm calling because I need your services." And his daughter was 28, 29 years old. She had been schizophrenic, depressive, rebellious, into drugs for years and years and years. She finally moved up to Minnesota, I think it was, and she was trying to look like she was going to get her life together again. And she moved. She emptied her bank account, gave all of her money to some preacher, and came to San Diego and got depressed one night as she jumped off an overpass onto the 5 freeway and survived it. But she was in a coma, vegetative state, and the doctors said, "We can keep her alive, but she will never be able to communicate with you other than blinking her eye for yes or no. That's it." And so they were thinking, here she has all these demons that she's had for years and years. How is she going to get the rage of the demons out of her life if all she can do is blink her eye? And he said, "It was the most gut-wrenching decision I've ever made in my life, to take her off of life support and watch her die." And my daughter's 30 years old, and I just could not wrap my head around what that must have been like. But God didn't fix that for them. He just didn't show up and fix that. But it's a part of the flow of life. And the one thing that stood out in all of it was, but God loved her more than we ever loved her. And we let her rest in God's grace and in His hands. And so death, you know, God is ultimately going to overcome death. Jesus has done it, and He's going to come back, and there will be no more death. And I don't know what I'll do in the new kingdom, because no mortuaries. Find something to do. But there is that realization that death is one of the flows of life. Death has shown me how to be gracious to people that I just want to, I was trying to say kill, but that would be self-serving. That I crewed was 6 weeks old. He had spent 3 of his 6 weeks in a hospital. The latest one, they airlifted him from Murrieta to San Diego to an intensive care unit. They brought him home. Everything looked fine. He seems to be in good health. A couple of days later, by the way, the day they brought him home, Cruz's grandfather dropped dead. So what was supposed to be this wonderful day of celebration, granddaddy died. And then about 3 days later, they went to get Crew, and he was dead in his crib. Mom and Dad were not married. The other surviving grandfather came in to arrange everything. He was a police officer. And he and I kind of hit it off because of my background. And at the funeral, Crew's father showed up drunk, just totally wiped out. And Cruz's granddaddy that I've been working with, named Kevin. Kevin did everything he could to keep his son-in-law, for no better lack of not having a better term, keep him from saying anything. But when the chaplain from the police department got up and said something about God, the daddy just went off on him. He walked out of the chapel, I don't know how many times. And then he got up and he just ranted incoherently for 20 minutes. And then we left to go to the cemetery. He just completely messed up that funeral. On the way to the cemetery, I wanted to know if he could ride with me. Sure. And it's like 3 miles from our mortuary to the cemetery. He said, "You know, I'm really a jerk. Always have been." And I didn't say what I wanted to say, but yeah, you're right. You are a jerk. We get to the cemetery.
And the chaplain, who was doing this out of favor to Kevin, inadvertently called Crew by the father's name, and the father just went berserk. And he went over and picked up the largest potted plant and slammed it into the grave and started cussing the chaplain out. And it just bizarre scene. But you know, someone said earlier, I met a friend here this week that I've known for a couple of years, but I've never really met him. But he was a preacher in Mississippi, and his wife and son were murdered one day. And you can read his story online. And Les told me this. He said, if you know a person's story, then their behavior makes sense. Might not be the right behavior, but at least it makes sense within the story. And so I was trying to, I didn't have that insight at the time, but I was trying to give this father some grace because he lost his the only son, it's the first grandchild, there was all this hope. And he was a beautiful little blonde-headed baby boy, beautiful. And he lost his father and his son all in this one swift week. And we just had to give him grace.
And I was praying to God going to the cemetery, what can I possibly do to just have some impact on his life? Which leads to my next story, because this industry has shown me that there are things in life I cannot explain, and I just quit trying. And here's that story. When little Crew died, his mom, 2 years earlier, had been in cosmetology school, and one of the students in that class had a baby that died suddenly. And so when Crew died, this woman found out about it and called the mother and said, I've been where you've been, and if you need anything at all, please call me. And she said, you have no idea how much that meant, that somebody's walked that road. So this mother had no, and the little girl that had died in her classmate's name was Mia. And she had no idea that Mia was buried at the Murrieta Cemetery. Murrieta Cemetery is about 14 acres. No, there's 1,400 graves there, acres and acres of land. And Mia's grave is about probably 150 yards from the office. And Mom and her dad were in there arranging for a burial. And she walked out of the office, walked across the cemetery, and just stopped and looked down. And she said, oh, look, there's Mia's grave. I can't explain things like that. But they buried Crew right next to Mia. And I've had many families come and tell me stories like that. And part of me wants to say, you've been watching too much reality TV. But, you know, there's a very thin veil between this life and the next. And these kind of things, I can't explain them, but they remind me of how thin is the veil. The business has revealed depth of character to me, both sides. I remember one death we did in California. If you're separated but not divorced, you're still legally married. And in California, the spouse has the right of disposition, control of disposition. So this guy had been living with another woman for years. They never married. He had never divorced his wife. And when he died, suddenly his family wanted to bury him, and they absolutely abhorred the thought of cremation. But the legal wife living in Florida found out what was going on. She came, she flew here, and she said, no, we're going to have him cremated. She did it for no other reason than spite. She didn't even want the remains. She just wanted to stick it to that family one last time. And then we see things like that. On the other hand, I had a young Army Ranger come in, and we opened our own crematory a year ago this March, and their baby died, and he was being, what are they doing? They send you to another place, transfer. He was being transferred from our area, Camp Pendleton, to some other state.
And we needed to get this cremation done because they were leaving like in 2 days. And when you have that fetal death certificate, it's a nightmare to get that thing through the system. And so we got to push through as fast as we could. And now we're going to do the cremation tonight because he's leaving tomorrow. And he asked my son, Josh, said, can I be involved in the cremation in any way? And Josh says, you can be involved as much as you want. What do you want to do? He says, I would like to do it all. And so we put on the suit. Was that well, with babies, it's not as hot, but it's, you know, several hundred degrees in there. And he placed his son in the pan and put the gloves on and the mask and all because of the heat coming out. And he pushed his son into the crematory, pushed the button for the door to close. 15 minutes later, he opened the door, he got the pan out, and there's the cremated remains of his son. But you have to do something with that skeleton. And he said, so what do I do next? He looked at Josh, and Josh says, well, now we have to, it's called processing. He says, what does that mean? He says, well, we have to grind the skeleton to the consistency of sand. But with the baby, you put, it's like the old druggist, you got the little bowl and the thing that you, and he said, can I do that? Josh said, are you sure you want to do that? He said, yes, it's my son. And we stood there with tears running down our faces while this daddy took that mortise and ground his son's bones to the consistency of sand. While his wife was in the other room with the pastor and they were praying. And I'd never seen that level of bravery. I mean, he's an Army Ranger, but still, this is your kid. And then when they got ready to leave, he put little boy in a little urn. He turned around and hugged our necks and thanked us. Thank you so much for what you've done for our family. And, you know, that's... You don't see that preaching at church. It offers unparalleled opportunity for ministry. One of the first families we ever dealt with, they came in and their firstborn child had died and they were devastated. And someone was in the arrangement room and so we were trying to get things where we could talk with them. And I walked out of my office and looked down the hallway and my wife was sitting cross-legged on the floor holding the hand of that mother and praying with that mother. And that's been 8 years ago, almost 9 years ago. And every Christmas, she sends us a letter of how well they're doing. They've got 2 boys now, they moved to Texas. And, you know, it's just like they're a part of our family. And we run into people downtown, and this is one thing I don't like about the business, because I have to be on my best behavior all the time. Because people see me around town, and, oh, it's Mr. England. I know that person from somewhere, but, you know. But we've dealt with over 2,000 people. And I was at Long Beach for 15 years and still didn't know some of the people that sat in the back. So when you're dealing with 2,000 people, you know, families, you remember. But they know us around town, and I have to drive better than I normally would. I have to avoid certain gestures that are common to driving in California. And be on my best behavior. Grief can also bring out the absurd. We had a lady that my wife was dealing with it, and she said, you're going to witness the miracle of Murrieta. And she honestly believed that God would raise her husband from the dead. And she came over every day. And she said, if I can't get in the building, can I just sit in the parking lot and pray? Because God's going to raise him from the dead. Because I know of a preacher in Philippines or somewhere, and he raises the dead all the time, and I know God will do this. And I don't know what's going on in Philippines and China places, and if God wants to do that, that's certainly God's prerogative. I'm not going to tell him he can't. I've just never seen it happen. Plus, our mortuary is not in Murrieta, so technically it wouldn't be a miracle in Murrieta. But it sounds better than a miracle in Temecula. So I was thinking, well, if this actually happens, do we have to give a refund, or what's, you know, where do we stand in the business side of this thing? But she She literally drove us nuts for about a week and a half because she couldn't decide. She just would not go forward with planning the funeral because God was going to raise him from the dead. And we see things like that. And it's an opportunity for ministry. But it also brings out some strange things. Let me give any questions or comments or a joke you're dying to tell me because you know I've never heard that. I started off for $20 if you could tell me a joke I hadn't heard. And I couldn't finish it before. And I thought, no, I'll probably lose my $20. Somebody's going to be clever enough to make up a joke. Some random thoughts for what they're worth. People say the stupidest things in the context of death. Earlier this year, a woman was holding her only child, 5 months old, on her knee, and she was bouncing up and down on the knee, and suddenly the baby just went to sleep and never woke up. Autopsy was done, and the coroner said, well, it was a drug overdose from a patch that she had on her leg.
Oh, wow.
And had no idea that it would go through the patch into the baby. What do you say to a woman that just felt like she killed her son? A child. What do you say? In this case, the father was a believer, but the mother was not. I think the best thing I've learned is don't try to speak on God's behalf. He doesn't need us to be a spokesperson. By the way, Mike Cope, if you go to preachermike.com and on the right side, he has a column of things, and at the bottom of that column, it's a series when a child dies. Mm-hmm. That's a wealth of knowledge on how to help people through. So I'm not going to cover everything that Mike covers, but I have learned it's best to say nothing but be there. Just be there. Most anything that you're going to say is going to just, you know, if you think that God needed another flower for his garden, fine. Keep that to yourself. If you think, well, this happened for a reason, fine, don't say that. Or, you know, God is in this. But we have to trust that God is doing something in your life through this. You have no idea, unless you've been there and wanted to slap somebody for saying it. I mean, it's just absolutely useless. Dr. Brené Brown is a research professor at University of Houston Grad School of Social Work. She says, rarely does a response make something better. What makes something better is a connection. Just be there. A lady in a class earlier this week said, action without words. She had been through it. We like to pull our friends and our family members out of their despair and into hope. But sometimes we just need to be there and keep our mouths shut. Grief and lament and sorrow are all a part of life. Matter of fact, the Bible has a whole book on that. It's called Lamentations. And you just got to let people work through that. And it takes time and it takes patience and it takes support and it takes presence and mainly it takes silence on your part. Just be there. They're in a better place. That doesn't help that person. True, they may be in a better place. You know, one thing else I've learned in the funeral business, absolutely nobody goes to hell. I don't care if they don't even know about God or Christ. Every sermon, every funeral I've ever heard, they send them straight to heaven. And if you're planning a funeral, do not use two preachers. We had one time, and the preacher got up, and this person was just pretty much a pretty vulgar person in life. And the preacher got up and sent him straight to heaven. And the second preacher, representing the other side of the family, got a first words out of his mouth. I don't know what Bible that brother's preaching from, but my Bible says this, and he sent the guy straight to hell. And most of his family. And we were sitting in our office saying, okay, who wants to go out there and take care of the end of this thing? I am good. But can you imagine Jesus telling Martha or Mary, you know, Lazarus is in a better place? What did he do? He wept. He cried. He entered their world of grief. Well, at least they're not suffering anymore. When you're going through loss of a loved one, you're not looking for the lowest common denominator. You know, no one wants their loved one to suffer, but they desperately want that person to be present, and they're not. And so, if you and I can't believe Jesus saying to either one of them, "Well, at least Lazarus is not suffering anymore." I've got a friend who was a therapist for years, and he says, my rule of thumb is this. If what you're going to say, if it can't bring comfort, don't say it. And then he went on to say it like this. If you were to whisper, whatever it is you want to say to this person, if you were to whisper into that, into the ear of a child being sold into the sex slave industry, if you were to whisper that into the ear of a woman being brutally raped while she's being raped, if you were to whisper that into the ear of a person in line to be beheaded by ISIL, if you were to whisper that into the ear of a woman who's, and I had this case one time when I first went into preaching, who's, her house burned down, her husband died, one of her children was addicted to drugs, dog got run over, and someone said, you know, God doesn't give us any more than we can handle. And her response was, then I wish I had no faith at all, because I can't handle this. If you can't whisper whatever it is you want to say into the ear of someone going through the worst moment of their life, and it's going to comfort them, then you don't need to say it. And quite honestly, I haven't come up with that thing that will comfort any of those people in those scenarios. It just doesn't exist. My mother, after Dad died, she said, if someone tells me one more time it just takes time, I'm going to hit them. I'm going to slap them in the face. I said, Mom, it just takes time. What about just simply letting that person know, I care, and I don't want you to have to go through this alone. And you don't say that, you're just there. Don't say you'll pray for them. Pray for them. Just pray for them right then and there. Ask them, what can I pray for you? And that might even come weeks later, because they're not ready for that at that moment. Don't say, if you need anything, let me know. Say, what do you need right now? What can I do for you right now? I hope this is not true of your church, but I've seen it so much in this business. Pastors are just too busy to deal with people in their grief. The whole pastor thing drives me nuts. And I told our preacher that. But I don't see church leaders among families in the context of death anymore. They're just not there. And that's horrendous. I know people don't like to face their own mortality, but we need to reclaim this ministry of grief. I'm almost done, and we're running out of time. And this is just my personal opinion, but I'm going to throw it out there, and you can do with it what you want. It could be controversial, but I don't think funerals are a time to become evangelistic. I couldn't tell you the number of people that have come up to me after and said, you're a preacher, right? And I said, yeah. Or with it, he's a current pastor. You know, why? This one guy lived in the colony of a place for people over 55. He said, we spend a lot of our time going to memorial services for people that died in this place. Why do these preachers think they have to save us? Why can't they just celebrate this person's life? And I didn't have an answer. Philip Yancey's book, Vanishing Grace, Whatever Happened, he said, I received a letter from an agnostic friend furious about Christians' behavior at her mother's funeral. She described the fear-mongering come to Jesus now proselytizing from the pulpit by a pastor from, ironically, Grace Community Church, something mega church. She said, the only reason I did not climb over the pews and run was respect for my mother's faith. And people said to her, well, if one person accepted Christ during the service, get ready for this, then your mother's death was worth it. Mm-hmm. Any preachers in here? Last Sunday, a preacher by the name of Kenneth Green, I never did figure out where it was, but Kenneth Green was preaching a sermon, down but not out. And he said, if God were to take me right now, I'm ready. And he died. In the pulpit. So I was just going to say, if you're a preacher, just don't ever go there. God might call you. Zap you up. If I could say one last thing. Well, there's no other classes after this, so if you want to talk, we'll hang around a minute. But at least have a conversation with your family. You can take so much off of your survivors if you'll have the conversation, what I want done when I die. Let them know. Talk about it. If you want to go another step, go ahead and fund it. So they don't even have to worry about the finances of it. And if you travel, I was telling my buddy Steve, because he travels a lot, I said, if you travel a lot, we brought families in from Europe and Africa and Costa Rica and Mexico and
Philippines,
and it costs a fortune to get your body brought back to the States. Many times it can be $10,000 or more, and you haven't even started having a funeral yet. But there's a $495 insurance policy if you're 100 miles from home. Now, you can only use this once. Think about that. But it never expires. If you're 100 miles or more from home, this policy will see to it that you are removed from the place of death, embalmed, and flown to the nearest airport to where you live. And I tell you, I've seen families just spend tens of thousands of dollars. Bosnia, Serbia is the other one I was trying to think of. It cost them a fortune to get somebody home. And it's so unnecessary. So have the talk. If you do nothing else, have the talk. Okay? Thank you so much for being here. I honestly didn't expect hardly anyone here. You have blessed my day, and I hope I've given you something at least worthwhile to be here. Okay?